event rap, performing at your virtual events. It all started last year, a pandemic, a new reality, no more live shows. I started rapping for Zoom galleries, but with the twist, only kicking original compositions specific to the event topic and to the audience in it. And people started flipping like, oh my god, it's a wrap up, a summary of everything that just happened to us. So I called some rappers up like, yo, you feel this? You wanna do some topical raps on commission? They said, hell yes, cool, sounds like it's a concept that we could build with. Think of it as the DoorDash of hardcore raps. You give us the topic and the budget, and we fill orders fast with that hip-hop format. Introducing event rap, as in we can perform at your virtual event rap. Amplify your message and boost your impact. There's no demand for this product, so what? We can invent that. Cause a rapper can help you to tell your story and bring it hella glory. Any message, any category, we do conferences, workshops, college classes, and birthdays, podcasts, and sales kickoffs with your workmates. Event Rap is a platform about to be in the App Store. It's your quick and easy original custom rap source. So book a rap reward, and we'll deliver the hype music and get some rappers paid for it. In other words, a bright future.
My name is Baba Brinkman, and my company is Event Rap Inc. And Event Rap is the first ever service for booking rappers for virtual events, live events, and to make you custom rap videos.
I'm intrigued by a couple of things already. So even before we start recording, I said that I just love the fact that I sent you an invitation. I literally found you. Like, I didn't find you. Someone put something on LinkedIn. You popped up, and I'm like, his name already intrigues me. So now I'm intrigued. I have no idea what you do because I don't really care to know what you do because I know I'm going to talk to you. So I figured I'll find out when I'm talking to you. But your name, let's just start from, well, one, thank you very much for being here. But two, your name. Talk to me about your name. Where did it come from?
So I'm originally from Canada. I grew up mostly in Vancouver, but now in New York. And my parents were, let's say they were hippies. They went to ashrams and meditated and
wait, ashrams, what's that?
Ashram is like a temple in Hinduism or Taoism where you go and do yoga and meditate and, become one with the universe. Baba in Southeast Asia is a designation for like a holy man or a monk. Like if you think of the classic picture of like a guy with robes and a beard on top of a mountain trying to meditate for enlightenment, in India you would call that a sadhu or also a baba. So apparently when I was born with a contemplative expression on my face. I was born not crying, and for my dad this was like proof positive that I was reincarnated from a mystical being of the past. And he was like, let's call him Baba. He's clearly a Baba. But it's actually not my legal name. It's a nickname that I got at birth. And my legal name is Dirk, which is also my dad's name. And it's a sort of strong European patriarchal tradition. But I've just always identified as Baba.
Okay. So you went as Baba. And again, your name is the one that hooked me in there. So in school, were you known as Baba or Dirk?
So I was Dirk through most of high school and elementary school. And then senior year of high school, I kind of like asserted my individuality and said, call me Baba from now on. And then when I went to college and all through college and ever since, I've been Baba to everyone.
And obviously it opens up a conversation.
It does do that. Although depending on where someone's from in the world, the conversation can be either awkward or not awkward. Because in the South, of course, everyone assumes it's Bubba, like Bubba Gump. in people that
not
are from
not realizing there's a U in there.
Yeah, I mean it's a subtle difference, but and then if you meet someone from like the Ukraine or Eastern Europe, Baba means like an old woman, like Baba Yaga is like a witch in the woods. But then most of like Asia and North Africa, they understand Baba as like a honorific for a father or an older man or a monk or something like that. So,
and then they see this young face and they're like, we are totally perplexed right now.
Not so young anymore.
So you are, you're younger than you, younger in my comparison. So I feel like I go back in the day, a 30-year-old looked old. No one looks their age anymore. So really, no one really knows. I mean, I turned 53 this month and everyone's like, what do you mean? I go, I know. We're like 53, 40, 30. No one looks their age.
Joie de vivre keeps you young.
Exactly. Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about the days of growing up. So I always say before we know about the business, we need to understand the individual behind the business. And so you already started by saying your parents were hippies. So how was it growing up? And do you have siblings?
I do. I have.
And I'm so sorry. And where are you? Where are you right now too?
I'm in Long Island.
Okay.
Yeah. And I grew up in Canada. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. And it was a very, very unusual upbringing. My dad was the founder of one of the first reforestation companies in Canada. Mm-hmm. So it was a tree planting subculture where a bunch of hippies would go out every summer and plant trees and live in a remote bush camp in like tents with trucks and load up trees and plant trees all day. And I used to hang around these bush camps as a kid, you know, watching the people go planting and like exploring wolf dens and climbing trees and just being like feral with my Canadian hippie kid friends. And then when I got older, I started planting trees myself and did it for over 10 years as a summer job all the way through college. So did my brother. So did my sister. Most of the friends I grew up with are all tree planters or the kids of tree planters. And my brother and sister still work for the family business. It's one of the largest reforestation companies in Canada. And they recently celebrated 1.5 billion trees planted in Canada over the last 45 years.
That is absolutely amazing. So, all right. So I shouldn't say worked, but I've mentored in organizations that, they have basically depleted the forest, in areas. So in Morocco, we'll call it, there's like a very well-known company that they are trying to convert their negative persona by going out there doing solar panels, getting trees planted. They're trying to fix the situations that they've done in the past.
They're rehabilitating their image.
Yes, exactly. Very good way. See, you should be working in my marketing world. I love it. And also I know people that are working for Bozy up in Maine, and it's one of those moments where there are companies that do it extremely well in regards to taking, like, we take but we give back. I go, and then there are companies that are not doing so well. So can you just talk to the masses about what are, I mean, so I'm from Haiti. So like my family's from Haiti. I was conceived in Haiti, born in America, but everyone knows the deforestation of Haiti has really depleted the country. And there's a lot of countries that are dealing with the same situation. For someone that just like is oblivious, educate us in layman's term in regards of what is it really doing to the communities when someone takes down the trees? I mean, and we're going to go basic, takes down the trees and they do not replant. What happens to the community in itself?
Well, I'd say it's a blow to the ecosystem at every level. The natural habitat's depleted all around, and that is a source of livelihood for people. I haven't been to Haiti myself, but I've read about it. I've read about the distinction, you know, you can see from the satellites, the border with DRC and with Dominican Republic, and, you know, how much more forested is there because of historical policies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it tends to be a historical government level thing a lot of the time in terms of like how much forest deforestation was encouraged or prohibited or regulated. And, you know, there really is a one-to-one relationship, I think, with degradation of the environment and impoverishment of the economy. They can go hand in hand if they're, you know, correctly managed. But my experience with tree planting is mostly, and deforestation is mostly in Canada, and it's remote areas where we're working. So it's not like there's a lot of people living around where the trees are being cut. It's like hundreds of miles of vast forests, and they designate areas to cut. And then the law, which I think is a good way to have the law be, says if a deforestation company cuts down trees, they have to use the profit from the sale of the logs to hire a tree planting company to come in and put a brand new forest in, so that a year after they cut the trees, there's already new ones growing, and there's no sort of rolling the dice about whether it grows back or not. It's just part of the policy. And that way, you know, it's regenerating.
I love that policy. So your parents created this company. Is it just in Canada? Do they partner with other countries that are like, look what you've created? Can you educate us in regards of how to do it better in our countries?
There is some Central American activities. So there's a Panama office, there's a Colombia office, and a Costa Rica office. And that's like a lot of tropical hardwood plantations. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a thing that's been happening slowly and is catching up steam, which is that forestry is not just great for communities and ecosystems, it's really important for climate change as well. And you know, the historical challenge has been like, okay, plant trees, we all love the idea, but who's going to pay for it? So one way is that a company wants to rehabilitate its image, so they put up the money in order to green some areas for historical damage they've done. Another way is, like in Canada, the forest, the logging companies have to pay for the tree planting out of the stumpage fees. But you know, another way you could do it is you could have a sort of carbon bank where people are paying to offset their pollution. You know, if you say you've got to bring your pollution down to a certain level to be consilient with the Paris Climate Accord commitments of net zero by 2050, and a company's like, oh my God, it's going to cost us millions to retrofit this plant in 3 years, but we could probably do it in 5 years. They could make up the difference by paying for a big area to be planted or for standing trees to be protected. And that's going to fund a lot of reforestation going forward. And the company, my dad's company, also works in the sort of carbon capture forestry space, which has been a small part of the business in the past, but it looks to be on the verge of growing a lot as people wake up to climate change.
Now, anyone that's coming into this podcast, like maybe they didn't catch the first part of this conversation in regards of your elevator pitch, comes into this and they're thinking, wow, this is a deep conversation, and they're not going to understand where it came from. So I love this because I interviewed someone that was in the Harry Krushner, which we didn't know. I have no idea. So I'm like, we're talking, and then I'm like, I go, your name, again, it's always the name. Her name was very unique. I'm like, I go, you're Caucasian and you have a name that stands out. Very, it stands out. She's like, I grew up in a Hare Krishna. I'm like, shut up. I mean, I was awesome. And she was so well-versed in regards of engaging with people, because obviously that was part of her culture where she walked up to total strangers at the age of 5. We're like, I go, this is what we do, etc. You have such a deep understanding of the environment. You have such a deep understanding of the situations that happen when any organization chooses to annihilate the ecosystem because of greed. I mean, it's not usually of greed. I mean, companies want to make money. And so how was
lack of options. Sometimes people do deforestation because they need to feed their families, and that's the best way to make money locally. You know, I think big corporations, yeah, the bottom line is what's driving them, and greed, yeah. But not all, you know, I don't know how much of Haiti's deforestation was caused by corporations versus just farmers like clearing a few more trees a year until it's all gone, right?
Well, the thing is, we don't talk about that side of it. Everyone just talks about the negative of these big, huge companies that don't take care of the environment. They don't take care of the people. They don't take care of the communities. So when you're even talking about that, that actually brings up the conversation for me, where this education for you, was it because you're there, you're with individuals that are your peers and you're having these conversations, or your parents were like, this is what we're doing and we need our kids to be very aware of the environment? There are three of you, brother and a sister. Did your mom and dad have this company before you guys were born? I mean, where did it come from, and why was it so important for them to continue with the company, but also to make sure that you guys are well versed in the subject? Because you're very well spoken on the subject.
Yeah. And I don't know how much it was really drilled. I think my parents were kind of live and let live types. You know, I'm trying to think of them like sitting us down to educate us. And, you know, that wasn't really their style. We just would sort of absorb it, because there would always be people in the house from different countries, from different cultures, like staying with us, visiting, and they would just, you know, talk about all of the policies and issues and stuff. And so we'd ask questions and be involved. And we just sort of it was like an osmosis thing. But, you know, honestly, for me, it was a family business. And, you know, personally, I have planted more than 1 million trees myself, because I did it over 12 years every summer for like 3 or 4 months a year. And I got my stats up over 1 million. And then I pivoted and started my rap career at that point. But, you know, what people hear that sometimes, like I go do a rap show and the host will be like, introducing Baba Brinkman. He's an award-winning rapper, but check this out, y'all. He planted 1 million trees. And I'll be like, yeah, I planted 1 million trees. But then the first thing I got to say is like, yo, this was not me doing charity work. I was getting paid for every single tree. That was just my summer job. And I, you know, it's kind of like being a factory worker in a way, you know, or like, we're, you know, being like an apple picker or something. Only it's more impressive to plant 1 million trees than pick 1 million apples for some reason, even though both of them are like repetitive outdoor jobs.
Well, so, but it's so funny, but it's, you know, like for anyone that works in their family business, everyone's like, I go, what you do this summer? I go, well, I worked in my family business. And that someone usually ends it at there, but it's many hours, whether you're at your family's restaurant, like my mom had a catering. So, I mean, I remember all the different parties that I catered. So when I waited tables in college, it was no big deal because I had already done it all my entire life. And so it is one of those moments where, yes, planting trees is, there's so much like, oh my God, you're so wonderful. You're saving the planet. You're saving the world. Versus if you are working at your family's restaurant, you don't get the same accolades.
Which is kind of luck of the draw, which family business you're born into, right? And I do recognize that I'm very privileged to have had a model since I was very young of a business that's good for the environment. And, you know, I do give my parents a lot of credit. My dad started the business really with a couple of buddies in the 70s, like, let's go out and have some wilderness adventures, but do it in a way that we're not going to be ashamed of ourselves afterwards, like if we're trying to cut the trees or be hunters or something. And so they found these tree planting contracts, and they were just kind of doing it as a summer adventure thing. My mom's more like the, you know, business savvy, entrepreneurial. She's got a master's and MBA. And so she came in, and when she and my dad got together, she like fixed his books and like brought in all these expansion strategies. And that's when it kind of turned into a big corporation. And they started running hundreds. Now there's like 1400 employees or something like that. And she doesn't work for the business anymore, but I definitely had, you know, this feeling or this sort of message all around me growing up where it's like, you know, there are ways that you can benefit society, benefit the environment, and make a profit. And you don't have to think of business as some kind of enemy of the people or enemy of nature. That's just a choice that businesses make. And a business can make a decision to have a positive purpose and make the world a better place and have that be the heart of their business model. With the purpose and the intention, you can succeed at it. It's just really funny now to see every business having like a purpose strategy and an ESG policy.
Sustainability, exactly.
Welcome to the party. Like this is not, it's not a new idea. It's just an idea that's finally catching on now. And a lot of the gigs that I do now as a rapper is I'll come in, like literally yesterday morning, I was with Bayer, the big pharmaceutical and agriculture company. And they had me wrapping a summary of their sustainable procurement supplier day. And it's like all of the stuff about how they want to be good for the people, good for the planet, still have profits. And, you know, I did like a wrap summary of their whole meeting. And they're like, wow, how did you get all the details of our corporate strategy so well? And I was like, quick learner, I guess. But really, like
quick,
the stuff
well, quick, I've been quick, with quick it learner, for 40 well, years. Quick so. Learner, but also you're hearing things. And we're definitely going to get to that. But I want to know, are you more like mom, the business person, or dad, the environmental, I want to stay and grow a business? Which one are you more of?
I would hope that I've tried to take the best of each. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of it is like a personality disposition. My dad's more like visionary empire builder, worry about the details later. And I definitely have a bit of that in me. You know, I get ahead of myself as a business person with like too many projects and I don't know how they're going to pay yet, but I just think they're like a great idea that the world's ready for. And then I'm like having to get reality checked all the time by, you know, the finances. Whereas my mom's more like plan way in advance and make sure the strategy's got all the checklists hit on the way. I'd say I'm like dispositionally more like my dad, but working hard to be more like my mom.
Well, I could see the vision in you because, I mean, in regards to the rapping and how you just mentioned that you've been listening to a conversation and it's like, bring all the best of it in a rap song. I could see the vision of it. So yes, I'm seeing things. Did you go to university?
I did. Yep.
What was your major?
English literature.
And see, it's coming together even more for me. Okay. Why English major? Because again, you could have gone business. You could have gone environmental. Why English?
Well, I was kind of just a poetry nerd. Like it was my favorite course in college and I wrote poetry at the time. You know, when I think back, it's like really hard for me to tell if I fell in love with rap as a genre because I was a literature nerd or if I was so attracted to literature because I was a hip hop head, because I was into rap from before I was choosing majors, you know, since I was like 11, it's like the only music that I listened to, but I didn't really make the connection that rap was a form of literature until later. So I was like, what are you gonna major in? Oh, English, like that's my thing. I'm a writer, you know, I like exploring ideas and history and reading poets and, you know, interpreting their work. And then at some point in my late teens, I had this aha moment. I was like midway through an undergraduate English lit degree, and I was like, wait, what is really the difference between Shakespeare and Chaucer and William Blake and John Donne and Biggie Smalls and Nas and Jay-Z and Eminem? They're rhyming storytellers that are engaging with their culture in the medium of the time through stylized use of words. When that hit me, I was like, from now on, I'm going to make my scholarship be about demonstrating links between traditional literature and contemporary hip hop, and showing literary scholars that they should be treating rap as a contemporary oral poetry form that's analogous to what Shakespeare and Chaucer were for their time. So that's like, I actually did a master's in English literature, and my thesis was about the Canterbury Tales as a poetry competition, mm-hmm. and how that's a lot like freestyle battles, like in 8 Mile, you know, using words to advance in society when you're born into bad circumstances, but your talent can elevate you. That's like a big theme in hip hop, right? The come up, you see it all through English literature as well. Like, I'm born poor, my father's modest, but wait till you see my poetry, that'll get me in with the king. You know, it's a thing.
Well, I mean, you're looking at Shakespearean plays, which is my, I mean, literally my all-time favorite, where it's just that the playing of the words and how they not only they're playing the words, what they're choosing and how they're intertwining. And I go, they're not missing a beat. I go, it is just such an amazing way of when you see someone on stage and how, I mean, even just like with Denzel Washington, he's like, they asked him, and they're like, why did you choose to do a Shakespearean play at your level? He's like, he goes, as an actor, it is a gift if you're able to do this, because it's not a simple language. I mean, it's like a dance. It's an absolute dance when you're on stage and you're moving your body, but you have to get the words just right. I go, and to make sure that you're planting the word so that that way that individual that you're talking to knows exactly where to land. It's just like, it's a dance. And so for me, whenever I see anyone that takes, whether it's poetry, whether it's in the Shakespearean language, when you put it together and you know it, you can like actually like your entire body encompasses it. It makes me so happy. But then of course I'm a country music junkie, which is the same thing where I can literally, my dog died, my girlfriend left me, my wife left me. I go, and everything comes together, but still it's a dance.
And it's so, storytelling, right? It's like
it's 100%, 100% storytelling.
Yeah. There's a nice parallel from the, you know, there's the Oscars to the Grammys there, right? It's like Denzel's doing Macbeth at the Oscars and Nas is doing his catalog at the Grammys.
Exactly.
And they're, you know, they're speakers of poetry.
You said very quickly that scholarship. Did you get a scholarship in school?
Yes, I did. Yeah, both for undergrad and grad.
Okay, well, you said it, so. I mean, this is where you catch up on everything. I hear things that you say, and I'm like, I'm going to hold on to that one. I'm going to bring it back.
Clearly,
you're not a dumb person. You're stupid smart. Like, really amazing.
Ironically, that's not the context that I was using the word scholarship in. I just meant like academics or study, like I focused my scholarship on, but as it happens, I did also get a lot of my college paid for by academic scholarships as well.
What was it that, I mean, you applied, but what was it that gravitated people the most to you getting those scholarships? Was it because of the poetry? Because of your writings? Like, what was it that you're like, because I mean, there's academic scholarship. I mean, like, and I just literally interviewed a young woman that she was an athlete, but she got an academic scholarship versus for her sports. And so what was it that they saw in you that they're like, yeah, this guy is king, like in regards of like his studies and his focus and his storytelling? What was it that really pushed that academia to the point where they were just giving you free money?
You know, it wasn't grades. I think I had the first year covered from grades from high school, but then uh-huh. my grades, you know, it wasn't enough. I think what it was actually like purpose and passion and focus. Like I would be writing really elaborate applications saying, you know, the study of English literature needs to be revitalized because it is in danger of just being a museum tour of dead texts. And what I'm proposing to bring to it is a perspective where contemporary hip hop, which is a living literary form being generated every month in the minds of today's young people, is linked thematically with the study of literature in a way that will make historical literature have additional context and understanding. And I really brought like the hip hop perspective in all guns blazing, and luckily I managed to find professors that were really interested in this idea. And you know, my degree is actually in medieval studies. So it was sometimes a bit of a fight where they'd be like, oh, that's an interesting parallel, but let's just focus on the Middle Ages here. And I'd be like, no, the Middle Ages is dead. Look at what's happening now and how similar it is to what's happening in the Middle Ages. And it was like, yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. I didn't get to interrogate the people that said yes to the scholarships, but you know, I wasn't there sort of like killing time until I could get a job on Wall Street or something. You know, I wasn't there doing an English degree because I couldn't think of anything else to do and it's like a nice default. I was like, I have a reason to study English and I have a contribution I think I can make by showing people that contemporary rap is a continuation of the Shakespearean tradition, and not just in a shallow way, but like every way you could possibly hope for it to be.
Well, already this is like, all right, so you are definitely someone that that pokes the bear. I mean, it is very clear. So where did that come from? Because at the end of the day, if I'm reading your, I'm constantly getting decks from a deck for anyone that doesn't understand. It's like the, when a startup or small business has a business plan, and I say this in quote, we don't look at business plans, we look at decks. So it's like usually a PowerPoint slide and that tells a story. And I'm constantly looking for the person that is literally poking the bear, literally putting a stake on someone's back and say like, there's a lion's den, get in there and try to like, tame the lion. So you are definitely I'm going to poke the bear kind of a person, which intrigues people. So where did that come from? Because most people, especially in the world of academia, especially when you're in high school, they're like, I'm not going to cause waves. I just want to get into the school. If I get this grant, if I get the scholarship, great. But even just in the words that you're saying in regards of how you wrote your essay, in regards of how you're challenging the English language, I mean, that is powerful for a young person. So where did that come from? How did it start to go in? And how did you actually flourish that? Because startups, small businesses, anyone that's listening, they want to do something different. We're looking at, I mean, millions, not even hundreds, but millions of people walking away from jobs, top paying jobs, looking to poke their own personal bear. So what did you do? How did your parents or how did your community help you grow that instead of just quash it? Because most young people, they're like, okay, can you stay in your lane? Can you stop talking? You're embarrassing us. They usually stop the madness from a young person, but you're clearly passionate and you're still passionate about what you're doing and what you're saying. So how did that flourish for you?
Well, I think my parents get credit for sort of always giving me the message that if I had a passion and I had a good idea and I had a sense of purpose, I should pursue it. I should never let society tell me you're better off just being a lawyer because it's safer. I never got that messaging from my parents at all. And you know, they're entrepreneurs and they're disruptors who wanted to look at the way things were being done, find a better way to do it and turn that into a business. And that's, you know, literally, I've just been observing that since I was young. And you know, there were like, my dad used to be like, oh, you need money? There's no allowance, but if I'll give you $10. And if you go to the grocery store and buy all the ingredients, you can go make chocolate chip cookies and sell them for $1 each to all my employees. And because you're the boss's son, they'll pay you the markup. And then you'll have enough to pay me back the 10 and keep the 20 extra that you made from all this, you know, like that kind of stuff. That was always like a game that my parents would challenge me to do that kind of stuff. So you know, disruption was never an issue, although I don't have an identical twin, so I don't know how much of it is a genetic predisposition. Maybe some people are just born provocateurs, and whatever society or whatever family they're born into, they're going to find a way to upend it. You know, I just don't know from the inside which one it is, how much nurture, how much nature.
God, I love you so, I mean, God, this is so much fun. Like I did not expect this at all. So this is like great for me. When you graduated, what was the plan? Where were you going to go? Were you going to go back to the family business? Were you going to do your own thing? Were you going to be the lawyer? Like, what were you thinking of once you graduated?
I mean, it sounds crazy in retrospect, but you know, at this point in my life, I'm 43 and I've never had any job in my life except for tree planter and rapper. That's my entire life. So when I finished my master's in 2003, I had planted trees as a menial summer job to pay for college. And I was like, all right, now I'm a full-time rapper. No job, just passion, just creativity. Let's make it work. And, you know, a lot of people, including my parents, were like, all right, so what's the plan to make money? And at that point, I had written a rap adaptation of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which is the sort of 14th century landmark work. and I was performing it at like talent shows and fringe festivals. And I had it wasn't a loan. It was like a Canadian government self-employment fund that was for people that had seasonal work and wanted to start a small business. So in 2004, I started my first small business and I called it Bubba's Word Productions. And the business model was creating educational hip hop performances, starting with the Canterbury Tales. So I'll come to your school, I'll perform my rap version of the Canterbury Tales, the kids will have a good time, and then after the show, they'll be like, tell us more about this text, and then the English teacher will have a way easier time breaking the Canterbury Tales to them. And that's the business I started in 2004, and it did all right, actually. I performed in lots and lots of schools, and I toured festivals all around the world, bringing my sort of theater, comedy, rap, Middle Ages poetry show to all these fringes. And I mean, I can go through all the stuff that happened after that, but long story short, I got a book deal about a year later, and it was published by a Canadian publisher. I got a 5-star review in the Scotsman, which is the big newspaper at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Then Cambridge University hired me, and I booked a tour in 2005 of like 16 high schools all over the UK, where there was like a Cambridge professor introducing me at each school. And these are like, some of them are rough, like poor schools. And they, but you know, Canterbury Tales is still on the curriculum. And this really posh English prof from Cambridge would introduce me. And she'd be like, in case you thought the study of literature at Cambridge was a dry affair, we have a young man from Canada here. He's going to introduce you to the work of Chaucer. All right, boys and girls, Baba Brinkman. And I'd be like, what's up, y'all? Let's do the Canterbury Tales. Check it out, it's the Miller's Tale. And I, like, just straight up like hip hop version of the, and those stories are dirty too. So the kids would be like, damn, can he say that at school? But it was literature, you know? So I did that for years. For like 4 or 5 years, I made a living mainly from traveling around the world, rapping the Canterbury Tales at festivals and colleges and high schools.
What a creative way to get this out there. I mean, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. What was the book about?
I mean, it was literally the Canterbury Tales rap. So the way I laid it out is like the original Middle English was on one page, like as it was written in the 14th century, and the rap translation was on the adjacent page. So you could sort of see the way the lyrics were being condensed into contemporary words. And then I had to write like a whole introduction frame, which was based on my master's thesis, framing all the themes that rap and the Canterbury Tales have in common that people hadn't thought of. And that, you know, that book is still on Amazon, and it's still used by professors to introduce courses and things like that. So, I mean, it's not really what I do anymore, but I'm very proud of it. And it was like a great ride to be the Canterbury Tales rap guy for several years.
Oh my God, I love it. All right, so I'm just gonna, like, let's just go right to the elephant in the room. Students, people hear a rapper, and then you walk out, and they're like, he has a beard. He looks like he could be, you know, Johnny Appleseed. Wait, he doesn't look like he could be Vanilla Ice or Eminem. What do you mean? This is so weird. So what is the reaction when people even hear that you're the rapper and they see you? And also just the rapping world overall. I mean, like, I grew up with the Beastie Boys. So it was well before Vanilla Ice, well before Eminem. I go, so the Beastie Boys were our world growing up. So that was like our love. I mean, I have a poster that literally has the airplane crunch and eat me backwards, which of course no one, I loved it when teachers didn't even realize it said eat me, but it literally, this was awesome because they were so creative. So what was it like for you when you started rapping? How did people perceive you and how did you convert them? Yes, you open your mouth and the magic comes out, but how did people convert you? Or, and also how did you convince people, hey, I'm a rapper, I want to sit there and help your classroom. And they're like, the classroom.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, like I'm a middle-class white Canadian. And when I say middle-class, I just mean, I grew up in like suburban areas and wasn't that poor, when I was growing up. But, you know, I think part of the reason it took me so long to start rapping, frankly, when people say like, oh, you're a rapper, and you know, I've been a rapper by profession since 2004, insofar as I haven't had another job but rap since then, although I find unusual ways to make a profit. But you know, I started listening to rap at 11 and I didn't write any rhymes until I was 19. And what was that gap? And I think that gap was about like figuring out how I could possibly do it authentically without being a culture vulture, without mm-hmm. being a cultural appropriator. And I could really see that there was a, you know, I didn't want to be Vanilla Ice. I didn't want to be accused of being someone that was just a tourist that was like aping the culture because, you know, they thought it was cool, but didn't really have a deep engagement with it. So I was kind of like a student of rap for a long time. And it was really that aha moment when I was in college. And I was like, well, if rap is a continuation of the English literary traditions, I can see a way I could engage with it authentically as a white guy that's a poetry nerd from Canada. I don't have the same story as my favorite rappers. I didn't grow up in rough areas or, you know, have no dad in the house or lots of other things that rappers talk about. I didn't have, you know, any kind of draw to do crime as when I was younger or anything, but also my circumstances didn't really require it in terms of like how to get by, you know? So then I made the content of my rap be about tree planting and poetry and like trends in history and, you know, challenges with girls I was going through or whatever. But it was like, it was the idea of like, keep it real. And keep it real, if you interpret that as keep it street, then that means some people should rap and some people definitely should not rap. But if you think of keep it real as keep it real to your own story and your own passions, then anybody can rap if they're good at it. And, you know, I felt like I had the skill. And if I always rapped and people were like, you suck, don't bother, then I probably wouldn't have lasted very long. But you get positive feedback. People are like, that's so amazing. I've never heard anything like it. And of course, there's low expectations every time I walk in the room because of what I look like. And that's okay. You know, that means I get to really convert people and blow their minds.
It's so funny that you're saying low expectations. Right now, Tiger Woods is, after a massive car accident, is out there trying to get that next green jacket. And every single sportscaster is saying, we have low expectations. I mean, we're just surprised he's out here. He should have either lost a leg or been dead. And we have low expectations. And so it is pretty amazing when you walk into a room and people just, you know the look. Because I mean, I get the look of where people meet me, they're like, oh, I'm like, I know you thought I was from California with blonde hair and blue eyes, because I don't sound like I am black. And everyone's just like, I go, yeah, we're sorry. I'm like, no, don't apologize. It's just, French was my first language. And I just like learned how to speak. And I don't put a color to the way someone talks. It's just like, you're just talking. And depending on your environment, you with the rapping, I love the fact that you took what you know, and then you rapped versus the trying to be like someone else, where too many times people do that. They're like, I'm going to mirror Jay-Z. I'm going to mirror someone else. And I'm like, you know what? You don't have to. It's you stand out more when you don't mirror the other individuals and you're creating your own way. You created the rap from the literature, from your masters, from your environment, from growing up in your family's business. You mentioned how you did a lot of other businesses as well. So why did you not go towards any of these other businesses? And what made rapping so, like, yes, you've been doing it since you were 11. I know lots of people that listen to rap, but it's not their profession. Where did this company come from and why the gravitational pull towards it?
So it's an odd position to be in right now. I'm really like going through a huge metamorphosis because I spent 15 years as a solopreneur, by which I just mean like I'm an artist who makes a living from my own work, but I didn't have employees. I wasn't carrying anyone on my back. I could say I was a small business owner, you know, there was like an LLC and all that. So that's what I say when I did other businesses like Bubba's Word Productions. And then I had a record company called Lit Fuse Records that I was using to release albums. And a couple of my friends, I put them on with the record company as well. Rap Guide Media was a theater production and media production company that I ran, which still exists. After the literature stuff, I did a whole series of science communication shows. So I had already established myself as like the academic rapper. I moved from the humanities to the sciences, and I did a climate change show and an evolution show and a neuroscience show. And, you know, I did, like, for like the last 8 years or so or 10 years, my whole hustle has been, what is a topic that matters to you and matters to the world? I can help you get it to the masses by creating a rap synthesis, an executive summary of whatever it is, the literature, the scientific research, whatever it is. You give it to me, I'll turn out a rap that you recognize as, you know, representing the research consensus on whatever it is, or the facts on whatever it is, and is really fun, you know. So I had already done this business model for years. I had made a career as a custom rapper for hire that just did video after video, album after album, always with a sponsor that would cover the production budget and pay me for my time and creative effort, because they saw the end product as useful. We want there to be a rap album out there that explains, you know, threatened species and the wilderness and protected areas. We want there to be one out there that explains, you know, evolutionary models for understanding disease and how it can drive research paradigms. So I, you know, I've done this whole series of albums on extremely arcane topics you would never think that would fit with.
But what makes it so, isn't so compelling? Because for the same token of the fact that individuals find it, it's up to beat, and I go, and it gets you going, and I go, you can feel the rhythm and the vibe of it. But there's a lot of people that just hear rap and they're like, this is negative, we don't want it. And yet these businesses want to use you. So what makes it where big corporate organizations find it, like, in order to get to an audience, we're going to use rap versus just plain old, no, I shouldn't say boring music, because not all music is boring, but to go the traditional
plain old country music?
No, hey, do not bash country music. I love my country music. You bad person, don't. But seriously, like, there's so many individuals that have negative, like, they automatically, they hear rap, they go negative all the way. But corporate organizations are gravitating towards you. Why now?
Well, I think it's not, I don't know if it's so much why now, as it's like, this is a way of doing rap that corporations can see where it's useful to them. You know, where some of the pitfalls that they're worried about are not going to be a problem. And it's really designed. But, you know, when I say corporations, I already feel a little bit weird about it, because, like, the concept of event rap is like anyone with a messaging purpose can hire a rapper that's really good, that's a skilled professional, 10 years plus experience, and the rapper will take that file on and turn it into an accessible, catchy, earworm music video. Now, you know, the stuff about rap having a negative reputation, I think that's kind of a natural outcrop of where it comes from. You know, it's an urban art form. It comes from places where people have had to struggle with poverty. And when people struggle with poverty, a lot of the times, the ones that want to, you know, do or die and make something of themselves go with the crime path. And then they end up also rapping about that. And it's real because it's their life. There's also studio productions that are like, some record label says you got to sound like a criminal, you're not going to sell records. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish between the studio gangsters and the real gangsters, but I'm not cynical enough
people would sit there and like blame Drake. They would sit there and say to Drake, where like, I go, Drake, you're Jewish. I go, you're from Canada. I go, how dare you rap? And he's like, I don't have time to listen to this noise. I'm doing something.
Drake is like the most peaceful rapper ever. He like never, he like never threatens violence. He just talks about how many girls he gets and how much money he has. You know, that's what we should want rap to be about. It's the ones that'll say, I'm gonna kill you. That, you know, that's what gives it a bad reputation. But I don't even fault them, because that's, you know, the environment they grew up in, and that's the behavior that was required for you to not be a victim. So I'm not going to judge, you know, but also, like, I do feel like people unfairly judge rap as an artistic genre when other art forms have the exact same thing. Like, you could watch a lot of mainstream Hollywood movies and say cinema is a violent art form. No, sex and violence are commercially viable prospects for storytelling. And that's the case with movies and with crime novels and with murder shows on Netflix and with rap. So why are you going to say rap is negative, but not television and cinema and literature? You know, it's like, it's just an unfair designation. So, you know, rap is a medium. It's an art form. It's a way of expressing yourself. It's a style of speech and music and rhythm. And any message can fit into it using the techniques that rappers have developed to engage an audience. Mm-hmm. And when I present it that way, then any potential client can go, oh, I see the value. And also, like, you just got to watch a bunch of the videos. You know, you know that we get the tone right for the topic. And sometimes the topic is more hard edge. Like, one of the videos that we've been commissioned to do is about a high school in Tennessee where a bunch of young kids all died from street crime in a short period of time. And they're really struggling with, you know, how do we disincentivize this lifestyle and engaging with the violence and really show people how much the negative consequences are while celebrating the lives of these young people whose lives were cut short. Like, that is not a corporate project, you know?
No.
That's like a difficult memorialization of a tricky social problem. And one of my artists was like, I love this topic. I have friends that have lost their lives. You know, I want to write a song about this to help the community heal. So event wrap is about like what message is the wrap needed for to reach which constituency we're going to tailor it to achieve its objectives. So it's like purpose-driven wrap, like utilitarian wrap in a way.
I'm going to continue with the elephant in the room. And I don't hem and haw on race. I go, it's more so because of the way that I was raised, being Haitian. I was just like, I focus on the people. But because we are in the rap world, and you just mentioned Tennessee, in America, it's always very white, black, very white, black. You're from Canada. Though Drake hears about it all the time. He's from Canada. Do you get gigs faster and more often because you're a white rapper versus when you are a black rapper? What are your thoughts? Because I mean, you're working for organizations, you're creating this amazing rap. You have a master's. You've been doing this for quite some time. You're easy to come in. Like I go, you're well spoken. You have all this. You're perfectly packaged. I could sell you. I mean, like you're perfectly packaged. And so what are your thoughts in regards of, I shouldn't say what your thoughts are, but have you had moments where you're vying for the same contract or for the same gig with another rapper that is not, I mean, like whether they're Asian, whether they're black, whether they're Hispanic, and then you're like, well, I got it. Not because you're not qualified, but more so because you're white.
That's a great question. And my short answer is I have no idea. I think maybe some audiences feel safer with me as the performer than if it was a black artist or any other minority artist. Maybe because I used to perform off Broadway and a lot of people would come see my show. And you, if you're selling a ticket to an off Broadway show, it can be like $50, you know, and it's like, are people going to pay that? And maybe I was creating like a safe environment for middle class white people to experience rap without having to feel unsafe or something. And actually, I've had theater reviewers accuse me of that. And say that's the appeal of this show. You can have a rap experience without having to go to a rap venue. And, you know, that's really an annoying analysis of what I'm doing because it's not my purpose at all. But, you know, I just don't know for each individual client, except one thing that's been an interesting test case is that because I was solo for so many years, I was pitching constantly. I'm going to make you a rap about this. Here's how much it'll cost. Right. A lot of those came back as no's. Maybe some of them came back as no's because I was white and they didn't see it as fitting with their diversity agenda to have a white face for their project. But since I've done event wrap, and I'm not going to disclose any individual client conversation.
Oh, no, you shouldn't.
Since I've done event wrap, I have had clients say, we really need a minority artist to be the face of this. You know, we've seen that you represent several. Can you make sure and nominate one of them for the job? And I don't mind that, you know, because I think different projects have different agendas and initiatives and target audiences. And sometimes I'm not the best spokesperson for whatever the topic is. And I totally am ready to acknowledge that. And, you know, here's the one other thing I would say about this. You were like, sometimes you're competing with another rapper for a job. It's kind of like never even really happened because I've sort of invented a whole industry here. You know, this isn't a thing that anyone else does, pitch themselves as a custom rap communicator of difficult subjects.
I've never heard it. It's, I mean, literally, like, I know of rap. I mean, obviously, we know rappers that were hired because of their popularity and then they rap, but it's never the other way around.
That's not event rap. Like, I wasn't sure how much that would be the case because now I rap a dozen artists now, right, including myself. And a lot of them have big fan bases and like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. So when I started the company, I was like, I wonder whether the fans of the artists I represent will say I want them to do a project. And it's just almost never happened. 9 out of 10 of the bookings we get, they're like, send us someone good, you choose. And that's really what I was hoping would happen because event rap is now like a quality control brand and you know you're going to get a dope rapper that's got 10 years experience in the hip hop game, but you don't know who it's going to be. And in practice, the clients never complain about who I choose because they know that they're all good. And that means I can rap a really diverse set of artists and I can curate, you know, this one needs a bit more humor. I'm going to send that rapper in. Or this one needs a really light touch with some difficult human issues. And I know this rapper's had some, you know, experiences in his life. He's the right one to speak on that. It's kind of like being the editor of a newspaper and having like all these journalists you can deploy to go to different beats. And, you know, so that like, I don't really have a lot of scrutiny into why they request a certain artist, or I think they request me more often than other artists, probably because I've got a lot of track record and content, and you can see what it would look like if I did a rap on topic X, Y, and Z, and there's like 30 topics I've done. But you know, when I started Event Rap, I had been doing this during the pandemic for a year as a virtual hustle. And I was like, man, there's going to be a lot of demand for this. It's a new thing, you know, so I need to bring in some help. And I reached out to all these rappers I knew, and they were all like, what you do is amazing. I would love to figure out how to get into the game. And I was like, I got you. I'll be your agent now and hook you up with work. You know.
How many people do you work with? How big is your team?
Yeah, there's 11 other artists besides me. So we're, you know, we're starting with the Dirty Dozen. I feel like that was an ambitious level to start at. I could have started with three or four. And you know, the concept behind Event Rap is that it's built to scale. Yep. So I can bring in as many new artists as needed to scale demand. But right now, you know, we're all staying moderately busy, not as busy as I'd like. We're only at year one at this point. And, you know, part of the challenge is like the cognitive dissonance. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, this is what we're going to do for you. And every new client and every new person is like, you're going to do what now? Like, it doesn't compute. But then when they see a video, they're like, oh, damn, like I could have a video about my thing. Or if it's a live performance at a conference or a meeting and it's like about the conference and it drops the names of every speaker and keynote in it, they'll be like, oh, I got a conference coming up. So I feel like it's catching on in terms of the buzz, but it's just so new, you know, it's like,
But I love it because it's so new. You go to, well, before the pandemic, you'd go to conference and they'd have an infographic designer. So the person would get on screen. It's the same. I mean, it literally for me, where it's the same thing, but it's the audio versus visual. And the person is just in the room and they're just drawing away. And by the end of the meeting, you're like, oh my God, how did they hear everything that was done? I mean, it's like, you have to have the most amazing ear. I mean, and humans by default, we're really bad at listening. And so when you have that skill of listening and capturing and regurgitating what a gift. It's an absolute gift.
It's a great analogy. It's literally that's what we advertise ourselves as, is like the live cartoonist, the live sketch artist, but rap is a cooler way to distill. Maybe cartoonists would take issue with that, but you know, it's also like when you get a rap, you get like a video that's like the Coles notes of your whole conference in 5 minutes with all the speakers name checked. And it's just like it's a very usable takeaway product after an event.
Well, as a former radio producer, I would say that you're more valuable. I mean, both talented, but you're more valuable because I can take you a lot further than the actual visual. So that visual is great, but it could only be used in certain mediums, where the audio could be used in all mediums. And so for me, at the end of the day, again, I work as a TV producer and a radio producer, but radio can go anywhere. Audio goes everywhere. And I think that what you're providing is such, it's just the bandwidth would last. It would last so much more. You started your company during the pandemic. What was it about the pandemic that made you do it? Number one. Number two, how did you recruit the people? I mean, you knew the individuals. I go, how did you recruit them? How did you find the right Dirty Dozen? And how was it during? I mean, we're going into year three of the pandemic. People just assume like, look, the pandemic's over. It is sort of kind of in the United States, but not, I mean, globally, it's not over. And every night at 5 o'clock in Massachusetts, we get a listing of how many people have, like, well, the people that are being tested, but people are still dying. I mean, every day, there has not been a day in the past month in Massachusetts that someone hasn't died. At least 5+ people have died from the pandemic, from COVID. So what was the experience like for you from March 2020, starting the business all the way through to right now where we are and where things are now starting to open again?
Well, ironically, like things opening again is virtually irrelevant to Event Rap's business model. And the tragic fact of the lingering pandemic is really a big factor on why we think we have a viable business going forward, because of how virtual centric the world became, especially the business world in the pandemic. And I think I probably had a similar arc to lots of people. Like, I spent the first 3 months of the pandemic thinking my career was over. Because I did like 130 live shows in 2019. I was all over the world, like comedy festivals, theater festivals, off Broadway. It was amazing. And then, it's like, oh, everything's canceled and now I'm stuck at home and what am I supposed to do? And I really had this attitude like virtual rap is pointless. You know, you won't feel the crowd, you won't hear their roar, you can't get that energy. You know, what could be lamer than sitting at home and live streaming a rap? And then basically the thing that changed my mind is after like, you know, sulking for a few months and watching the world go to hell, I started seeing people posting, oh, we're doing a virtual conference on Zoom. And so I just was like, okay, I'll offer to rap at your conference for free, just, you know, to keep myself busy. And I did a couple of them and I was like, oh my God, virtual rap is amazing. I actually love parts of it way more than I used to love live shows because the gallery is so intimate. So when you say a punchline that gets a laugh, it's like you're 2 inches from everyone's face as they react and you see so much visceral emotion where they're like, ah! And it's like, oh man, I started watching the gallery videos for my rap sets and I was like, this is gonna be huge, but nobody knows it yet. Because what's the business model, right? Sit at home and stream on Twitch all day and who are you even rapping for? And then you're just doing it for like fire emojis. So what I started to do is just reach out to everyone in my network and say, virtual event, I'll rap, virtual event, I'll rap. And I ended up getting a ton of business. In 2020, I earned more money than I did in 2019. And it was all virtual, like popping up in conferences. Oh, and here's the other pivot. Like I used to write a show that was like 80 minutes long and I tour it to festivals and do it off Broadway. It'd be like, here's my comedy rap deep dive on neuroscience or on climate change. But that part of my sort of frustration at first in the pandemic was like, who wants to sit and watch me rap on Zoom for 80 minutes? And like, we're all way too fatigued. But then when I had the aha moment, I was like, every set is going to be 10 minutes long at most, but it's going to be concentrated and it's going to be about the topic the event is about. So I'll go into every event with a blank word processor document, write my notes based on what everyone says, write the bars really fast. And when it's showtime, drop the beat and summarize the event. And that's the thing where everyone was like, I've never seen anything like this. And I did like 50 gigs in 2020, paid gigs on Zooms. And then at the end of 2020, I was like, this has got to be an industry. It's not going to be just one guy. And I knew all these rappers in New York, mainly from the freestyle battle scene, actually, because I still sign up for freestyle battles. I don't know why. I'm like the oldest guy there, but I just do it for fun.
Because you're smart and you never want to get to the point where you're archaic and you have to sit there and double check it. Like I go, let's just see if I'm good at what I do. I mean, I mentor all the time and everyone's like, you don't have time to mentor. What do you do? I go, because I want to make sure that I'm teaching what I know. So
yes.
It's a smart way to do it, to still go in battle.
So I knew who was good and I knew who could think on their feet, but you know, it was a bit of a leap. Cause it's like, okay, I've seen you guys freestyle. You're amazing. I've listened to your written songs. They're great. Here's what I need you to do. I'm going to send you into a Zoom meeting and you're going to write the rap on the fly, or you're going to freestyle live based on the comments they put in the chat, or you're going to make them a song based on their little topic. And you know, not two of one, every rapper I invited was like, hell yeah, let's go. I love this idea. Right. But it's on me to find them work. It's just like queue up the work and bring them in for each one. And you know, so it was March 2020 that we incorporated, we launched with a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter had like 40 bookings come in as rewards. And that was like our prototyping. Okay. Yep. Now we're going to do a song about this and we're gonna do a song about that. And we're going to come into that event. And you know, let me tell you what's the most exciting thing about Event Rap for me. Every gig we do seems like we've prototyped the whole industry. You know, we come into a class and we summarize the whole semester. I'm like, how many classes are out there? That would be amazing to have a rap summary at the end of the. And then I did a funeral last year and I.
No!
They brought me in and I listened to all of the eulogizing speeches and I did an in memoriam rap about the.
No way! Now that's cool.
Yeah. And at the end of that, I was like, wow, I wonder if anyone's ever done that before. And the next thing I was like, how many funerals are there? And you can uplift the mood in every one of them. And like, we've done birthdays and then also like corporate events, obviously, like team meetings, SKOs, customer connects, like it's all boring, right? Because it's all on Zoom and it's all exactly the same. And also there's a thing about like how many art forms were out there before and how many of them translate well to virtual. And like, not all of them, you know, there's a
bottleneck. You know what? A lot of people, think about it. Like I go, that company that it's like, I go, we're going to bring food trucks in. Well, you know what? That food truck doesn't resonate when every one of your employees are in different places. But then all of a sudden they were partnering with companies where like you get a gift box. I mean, I got a lot of gift boxes from clients And I'm like, bravo to you for coming up with a creative way of incorporating your other clients, and you got a gift box. So there are companies that did it really well. We're like, we need to think out well outside the box. So we're drawing way outside of the lines. And there are the companies that didn't know better. I mean, I worked with some companies that they're like, I mean, big, huge corporate companies that everyone knows their names, and they could not, their marketing department, their HR departments couldn't get out of their own way because they've had this job. They've done it always the same way. This is what I get paid. And I don't get paid to like think outside of the box. And so for any company that engaged with you, bravo, bravo, bravo. What do you think about, well, actually there's, let's see, which question do I want to go for? I'm going to go for this one. You have talked about all these different hustles, different jobs, different things that you've done. What was your inspiration in regards of like constantly challenging yourself to do more? Because someone out there, again, we're watching a great walkout. People are leaving jobs. People are tired. Like I went to school. I got the degree. I got that job that mom and dad wanted me to get. I hated it. And the pandemic pause forced me to realize this is not what I want for myself. I want more. What was it that driving force for you in regards of engaging and challenging yourself to do more? And what advice would you give to someone that wants to do that for themselves? That fear is their number one barrier.
Well, I'm gonna slightly reframe it, because for me, like, I have had no safety net since 2003. So the idea of like just being entrepreneurial and in reinventing yourself every year as needed is really natural to me, because it's like the air I breathe, and I've always done it. But for me, the really scary leap was bringing a whole team with me and doing something that's bigger than myself and saying, this thing that I do on my own, it's ready to franchise. And that's going to take a real risk tolerance that I've never had, in terms of like, okay, how much debt am I willing to take on to make this company work, and how much do I believe in it? And, you know, I don't know what pushed me over, except I would just say the pandemic. The pandemic changed the whole economics of where people are doing their events and where the budgets are going to go. And there was this big gaping hole that I was like, rap is so ready to fill this, to be the entertainment go-to option for all these events. And because the pandemic's dragging out, and also just because of the economics, like even when the pandemic's fully gone, it's going to stay virtual for most stuff, because it's not a waste of money like going to in-person was. And I'm going to add one more thing. Like, in the back of my head, I've had a grievance with the way the rap industry works for a long time. It's like a pyramid scheme. You know, it's like the leakiest pipeline in history, where millions of people have a passion and a purpose for the rap craft. They learn it. They spend a decade getting amazing at it. What percentage of them actually become rappers that make a living from it?
Like, oh my God, the same percentage of individuals that go and become basketball stars.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, the rappers, like I know a lot of people that rap and they're amazing and they have day jobs, right? And for like with basketball, like you don't really have like day jobbing basketballers pursuing their dreams. You know what I'm saying? There's like a trajectory of like college ball, NBA maybe, or farm teams or whatever. But with like with rap, it's like I know people in their 40s that still, you know, think they're gonna make it in the mainstream rap industry and put every spare hour into that. And they're amazing rappers and they've released records for 20 years. And the economics are so hard, and there's so much luck that's involved with who gets put on by the media machine or a record label or whatever. You know, so I'm, like what I really want to do with Event Rap is much more ambitious than what anything I've achieved or even talked about. What I want to do with Event Rap is create a middle class for the rap industry. Mm-hmm. So it's not all broke rappers and millionaires, but there's a way to be a working rapper. When's the last time you heard about a working rapper? Like there's working actors, you know? There's
well, no, you know, it, I mean, so the, for me, what you're describing is, I feel like what's happening in the college sports world, where the NILs, where the colleges were making so much money off of these young kids, but the second they graduate, you know, these kids are not going to go pro, but this is their moment of time to make as much money as they possibly can on their likeness, on their name, their likeness. And so for you to come up with this middle class, it's like you've been rapping forever. I go, and yeah, you can rap till you're 40. I mean, it's not like your body's giving out unless your voice gives out, but yeah, your mind is still working. You could still create these words into a rhyme, into some form of poetry. And now this, you're giving them the opportunity. And so I feel like the pandemic has opened up an opportunity for so many people, where you don't have to be in front of a crowd. You don't have to be in front of one individual. I mean, you could just do it in any way, and you could do it on a global platform, because you're from Canada, you're in the United States right now. I go, but you're, I mean, you consider engage with rappers from anywhere. They've seen you, they know of you, they can Google you, and now you can engage with individuals that are everywhere.
And you know, the other factor that's so crucial is just topic diversity. You know, so many rappers feel like they have to rap about a certain set of topics or there's no chance they're going to sell a record. And mm-hmm. a few people are real innovators and they're like, I don't care about what the commercial demands of the industry say. I'm going to go my own way. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to make it. But mm-hmm. under the event rap model, you don't even choose the topic. You just get your skills up and the mm-hmm. clients choose the topic. And once you're assigned the topic, you can say whatever you want and really bring your own voice to it. But like, how many topics are covered by the mainstream rap industry or even all published music yeah. versus how many topics are out there waiting to be covered, you know, but there's no way
it's that's financial. Endless. Yeah, and,
but the incentives of the music industry will never incentivize rappers to cover those topics. What you need is a Renaissance patronage model, like the Medici's paying Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel. That's a paid commission, you know, but it's still an amazing piece of art. That's what I want for rappers.
Well, I mean, I would sit there and I would just add to that where what I want for rappers or for any artist, whether it's like dance, whether it's music, whether it is paintings. I mean, I'm looking at a John Legend that just goes out there and he's like, I'm going to write a song on Ukraine. If you hear John Legend, you're not thinking song about Ukraine. You're not thinking about how he intertwined all these artists, a poet, a singer, a cellist. When I was in cellist, she was like, I forgot what instrument she was playing. But I mean, I go, that is for me, a great mind when you are bringing all this talent to you and you're like, the world's words are your topic. And then they're like, no one's given me the opportunity. So for you to open the doors and provide an opportunity for all these different individuals to be creative in a different way, I think that right there is what your parents did, where we're going to plant trees, lots and lots and lots of trees, and we're going to let you do whatever you want to, and we're going to let you poke the bear. I think all of that comes together and is making you who you are. It is definitely scary when you're in charge of a team. That right there is like, it's overwhelming. But I think that you are the perfect Mr. Million Dollar I planted a tree. I think that you're up for the task of the challenge of making sure that this is for a bigger audience in a nutshell, which is amazing.
I'm so excited about it. Honestly, I'm not sure if it's going to work. I might fail miserably. I've never been a startup founder, a CEO before. But I'll tell you one thing I'm very confident about. Either I'm going to do it or someone else is going to do it. Maybe someone is going to start a rap company that'll beat event rap because they'll do it better. Yeah. But I'm really confident that the event rap, topic rap, custom rap business mm-hmm. is going to blow up. It's just so ready to blow up. I did it first. Will I do it last? Will I do it best? Who knows? But we're trying to trailblaze here and it's just really exciting. Every day is exciting.
Well, let's just keep going on that. The industry overall, the industry of rap overall, where do you see it going? Because again, when it first started, I mean, the Nancy Reagan days where she's like, oh my God, rap is bad. Don't put it there. And I remember even Kool and the Gang, where I remember, again, showing my age, I'm 10 years younger than, 10 years older than you, I mean. And so I remember where certain songs couldn't be played in school because they were going too fast and they were talking about girls' butts, but they were still doing it in such a clean way. And then of course, well, Mr. Smith, I know Mr. Smith is getting a really, really, really bad rap right now because, you know, inappropriate. But even back in the day where Will Smith, Ego, and all these other rappers came out and teachers were like, too fast, don't like it. So where do you see the future of rap going from this point on?
Well, I think it's going to keep diversifying in terms of the style. I think one of the trends from the last 20 or 30 years is like, it starts in New York, and then there's like a California style, and then there's an Atlanta style, and there's a Houston style, and there's a Memphis style, and they're all like regionally distinct styles of rap, and there's like European rappers and Australian rappers, and Canada brings out their own talents. I think that's going to continue because each region sort of picks up on rap from the mainstream commercial top 40, sounds a bit derivative of it at first, and then finds their own voice. And if you think about that process applied to every city in every country in the world, there's the potential for rap to diversify so much, but still, you know, stay core to its roots and its principles as an art form. You know, I'm just more interested in what's going to happen with the industry. You know, like rappers have a path to success. It's a narrow path. It's like got to get a certain number of followers, you know, how viral, TikTok streams, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, what's going to happen with rap, hopefully will be influenced by what Event Wrap is doing. That's my humble ambition. I want the Event Wrap, the custom wrap industry, to rival the mainstream wrap industry. And that's a crazy thing to say when we're only doing, you know, however many gigs a month or something right now, but how many events are out there and how many topics are out there? It's just a matter of like really planting the seed in people's minds that wrap can help them with their problem, which is a boring event or a topic that's not reaching enough people. Mm-hmm. And if that idea spreads, then I see wrap diversifying even more than just all the regional and stylistic diversity, because the topic diversity is really where the crazy range is out there, right? Every topic, every business could have a wrap, every course in every college, high school, like this is human knowledge needs to be represented in concentrated form in wrap videos. It's like the best way to get an idea across, but that is not the way people think about wrap. They think about like artists hustle to make it platinum. That's one narrow path.
I love the way you say this. And of course, I'm going to bring my country right back, because back in the day, Garth Brooks was the one that was like, I go, I'm going to sit there and like turn country music over and I'm going to go mainstream and I'm going to do this big concert in New York City and in Central Park. And everyone's like, no one's going to come. And it was slammed. It was like, I mean, wall to wall bodies. And you're looking at country music right now, whether it was the Grammys and the CMAs are coming in. You see a lot of rappers collaborating with a lot of country singers. And it's like, it's amazing how the stories are just, they resonate with the audience. And so I think that what you're doing is exactly what is needed, because it's already being infiltrated. I mean, music is all that people are collaborating. Even Eminem, where it's like, I go, the basis of my music is coming from all genres. And I'm just putting it into the forefront for you guys, because you forgot about all these different ways of music. And I'm getting my inspiration. I'm sampling things here and there for a reason, because they've always been around, but I'm bringing them to you, to your door, in a way that you will understand it. Because the kid that is in Detroit, okay, so the kid that's in Detroit, if he can sit there and listen to Shakespeare, and if he can listen to Mozart, if he can listen to, you know, like, I mean, Maya Angelou's poetry, and he puts it all together, then you know what? Everyone else can too. So I love what you're doing in every single way. I've taken way more of your time, but you just gave me so much to work with that I couldn't let you go. So I'm super, super excited. We are going to do two things. So there's one request that you said that, because you talked about how you can listen to someone and you can actually like hear what they're saying and then create a rap. So I want to see you create your magic. So I'm giving you that moment, because I'm sure people are listening thinking, he keeps talking about it, but I wonder if he can do it. So let's see you, before I ask my last question, I'm giving you that moment of time.
Okay, what? Give me some topics. I'll freestyle on some topics. You say three things for me to work into the rap.
Okay, pandemic. Let's just say pandemic, small businesses, and I'll just give you a little phrase. So, people are waiting for small businesses to fail during the pandemic, and they have thrived.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it like this. Yeah, yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2, Baba break, but yeah, yeah. Check it, I come with those freestyle rhymes. It's a pandemic, but the small businesses thrive. You can't stop them, no, they won't go extinct. Then you can take the message from Baba Brinkman. I'm here right now with my Event Wrap startup with Jody Tatiana Charles. What? That means we're getting that message out. Spread it all around, it's crazy. Take it from Canada to Haiti. No more deforestation. No, we gotta grow trees. Baba Brinkman coming with the freestyle over dope beats. Yes, indeed. Yes, I'm getting in so deep. Plus, reforming this whole hip-hop industry. That's how I spit it on a record when I said it. It is not the end, it is just a short pandemic. We got to just revise the whole economy. I wanna do that by putting rappers on lots of beats. It's how it goes, yes, this is freestyle. Yes, this is small business industry style. We gotta grow them like some baby plants. And that is my whole philosophy and my stand like that. Brah. There we go.
All right, I can't even imagine how you would do it for a funeral. That is the coolest thing.
The funeral was a written text. And I chose every word very carefully. I would hesitate to freestyle at a funeral, but I would do it if they wanted me to.
That is like, you know what? I mean, I have to say that is so much fun, because for me as a marketing person, I walk into a room and my brain just does it. I mean, like, look, perfect example, my mother and I went to Disney World for Christmas, and I was like, my mom's like, turn it off. I'm like, I can't turn off marketing. Like, I mean, I'm in marketing world, right? I mean, it was just like, to be in the right place at the right time, good marketing, bad marketing, I can't turn it off. It's what I live, breathe, eat. And for you to be able to do what you do, and you walk into a situation, and you're probably, I'm assuming, you're probably thinking of rhymes in any situation. Could you, like, baby being born, funeral, supermarket?
You gotta be ready. You always gotta be ready.
I think that's absolutely, like, bravo. I am so amazed and impressed with it, from mom, dad, just going straight through. This is crazy amazing. All right, well, and you're
I want to give you a celebration as well, because you know, this is a great format for a podcast. At the first, when you first was like, you know, talking about how I was going to do my whole bio and lifestyle, I was like, oh God, why? I've told this story 100 times, but it's actually been like a really enlightening way to think about the context that event wrap blossomed from. So I appreciate you for putting this whole format together.
Well, this is why people send me things. I'm like, I go, I'm not going to read it. I go, one, I'm busy. Two, there's a part of me that's lazy, but also my parents taught me how to communicate. So I go, I can hold a conversation, but it's not about me, where I have the same 7 questions, which I tell people, same 7 questions. I don't get through to all of them because something you said will always engage me where I'm like, oh, we're definitely not talking about that. We're talking about this. I go, and your name was it. I mean, your name was the start of this bigger conversation, which I love. I mean, find ways to stand out. I go, and yay, mom and dad, for like your nickname. I go, and but your nickname was just one little moment. And then, dude, every single thing you said, it came out. We're like, damn, you were dropping so much education on us. And one of the things that I love the most, and I say this all the time, when I leave the country, I'm always amazed at our international our peers are so well versed in what's happening in the United States, so well versed in regards to knowing what's in history. And I mean, and I'm like, we are lacking so much in our school systems here. We're lacking so much in regards of conversations at the dinner table. And when I go overseas, I'm always just bravo for letting young people learn and engage and challenge. And so bravo to your parents for making sure the 3 of you guys were always engaged in what was going on. And I think this is what made you that much more intriguing as the rapper, as the, we'll call it, the literary, whatever you want to say, the literary guru that you are. But they added so much to they allowed you to grow. And you took that growth and you just made it your own, which is what I love the most. So we're just going to get, not to you, round of applause to mom and dad. All right, wait. So I see, is that a wedding ring? Are you married?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay.
And what does your spouse think about? 8-year-old. Sorry, go ahead.
All right. So what does your family think about that? Well, about what you're doing?
I mean, I was doing it before I met my wife, and she's proud of me. She touts me whenever she goes around and stuff. So yeah, she's been very supportive, and vice versa. She's a professional as well.
And did you marry well? Because the pandemic had everyone at home with their spouses.
Yeah. I mean, luckily our kids keep us very, very busy. And, you know, our bond was not based on going out all the time. So it's been fine.
All right. I love that. That makes me so happy. Because I think that, especially as an entrepreneur, you're working so hard on what you're doing. And some people don't understand the entrepreneurial ecosystem. They don't understand the world that we're in and how we're willing to put so much into what we're doing. And if you don't marry well and you're creating magic, it's hard. It makes the job even harder. All right. So my last question to you, because again, I've taken way too much of your time, but I loved it. And I'm going to be very selfish about the fact that I loved it. But I end every single conversation with the same thing, where you had a personal ask and a professional ask, what would it be? We focus so much on our companies, but we don't focus on ourselves. I'll give you the opportunity to answer 2 of these questions.
All right. So I'm going to say, for the personal ask, if you're a parent, say yes to your kids' visions. Because there is a lot of fear about making them go somewhere safe or somewhere that's going to pay or somewhere that's respectable. But, you know, there is a lot of value in a crazy idea that gets pursued with passion, especially when it doesn't sound like it's going to work to most people. So, you know, empower your kids to do what they want to do with their lives and trust that they will find a way to make that work and to make it help the world. And everyone's going to be better off that way. And if you don't have kids, then give yourself permission to do that, because it's a gift that you can give yourself to. That's my personal ask. And my professional ask is, think of rap differently. It's not just what's on the radio, and it's not just what's been said in every rap song so far. It's what it can accomplish and the feelings that it can invoke in any person. It's the best art form for making you feel hyper, making you feel excited, making you feel joyful. I mean, maybe I'm not trying to diss all other art forms, but there's something about rap that really is the energy giver. And once you apply that to all the other places we need energy, I think that's going to help my business and help the world's perspective of what rap is.
Bubba, it has been a pleasure. The sparkle in your eye and the big smile whenever you talk about rap, about everything that you've gone through. I mean, I'm so happy for you. I'm really, really happy for you. I really have to find out who posted you on LinkedIn, because you're a gift to me, because I would have never, ever even understood. I would have never thought that this existed. So I'm super excited that I can help you get more people to understand what you do, how you do it. I'm like, bravo.
Thank you.
I'm
Thanks
so excited.
So much for
Thank
the
you.
Invite. Thanks for reaching out. Thanks for being proactive. I'm really glad we did this.
Oh, well, the former producer in me will always be that. But I mean, thank you for promoting you, because sometimes I send an invitation or ask, and people are like, you are like, boom, not a problem. I'm like, I'm in it. So thank you for understanding that you need to market yourself as well. So bravo, bravo, bravo. And this is not the last time. So this will come up again. You never know. Something may happen at the CMAs and the Grammys or whatever. And I'm like, I know a resource that's actually in it. And I would rather use you guys as resources and go to an academic or someone that doesn't relate.
Well, I look forward to speaking further offline as well. I feel like we've made a bond. So it's
oh, absolutely. I can think of people that would really, really like to actually use you. So we'll keep in touch.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jody.
Bye. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. You too.